Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 169, Flesh is Primary, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, September 2nd, 2009. And in this installment of the podcast, I will be playing the bulk of the interview that I previewed for you last week. It is with Derek Jensen. He's an author and an environmentalist, and he's written a great many books. The only one I've read to date is Welcome to the Machine, which is about the emerging apparatus of the panopticon state. And this installment of the Sea Realm podcast is very much a Sea Realm community effort. First, the interview with Derek Jensen was facilitated by an introduction from Sea Realm listener Ed Yersch. Ed is the host of a Tuesday morning radio show on radio station CKUT, and he has on occasion played clips from the Sea Realm podcast. And he had Derek Jensen on his program a few weeks ago, and after the interview, he sent Derek a note saying, "You should be in the Sea Realm, too." And Derek accepted, so thank you, Ed Yersch. Next, I'd like to thank Ian B., who is producing music under the name Tonal Oak, and Tonal Oak provides the musical interlude this week. I'm afraid I forgot to write down the name of the song, but it's very much along the environmentalist theme, if you really tune into the lyrics. I think if you get past the really catchy guitar sounds and electronic noises and such, you'll find that there is a message deep down that resonates with the interview with Derek Jensen. Also, the cover art this week was provided by Dharma Awakenings, and Dharma Awakenings is among the tiny subset of the Sea Realm listenership that I've had the pleasure of meeting in person. In fact, she came to a farm where I used to work in Arkansas. It's run by my friend Patrice Gross, who's been a guest on this podcast, and then we had lunch at a small cafe in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is a very soulful place. It's run by a very soulful person whose name escapes me at the moment, but I'm sure I'll remember as soon as I've got this posted. And Dharma Awakenings is a painter and an artist generally, an artistic soul, but a painter in particular, and I have used her work as the cover art for previous episodes, and this week I'm using once again an image sent in by Dharma Awakenings. So I'll post a link to her website in the show notes for this episode. Of course, you can find that at kmo.livejournal.com. And then there are the people who clicked on the PayPal donate link on the crealmpodcast.podomatic.com page. And this week, those folks include Bryce B., Michael B., NZ Day, Eric R., and Mariah C. And I should also mention that Mariah C. sent along an email with her donation, and she expressed the following. "Hi, KMO. I was really surprised to hear in your Subjective Time and Evolved Morality podcast that you receive far fewer donations from Americans than you do from people elsewhere. That's sad. Well, C stands for coercion. I'm just kidding, but your statement did make me send in a donation. I do find meaning in the Sea Realm, and I care enough to support it. Your podcast resonates with me more than any other, and I would be in anguish if it ever went away. I spend the best hours of my day at a corporate job, and it would be so easy to give in to despair if I didn't have the Sea Realm to reassure, inspire, and encourage me. Thank you for your hard work. It is a truly worthwhile endeavor. Sincerely, Mariah C." Well, Mariah, thank you very much for your kind words. They inspire me. And this week, 4 out of the 5 sponsors are in fact from the United States. The only one outside the United States is NZ Day, who comes from New Zealand. So thank you to everybody who, either through financial contribution or through other contributions, contributed to the creation of this week's installment of the Sea Realm podcast. And there are 2 other benefactors I'd like to thank. And they are Mark and Anna at WaldenEffect.org. And Mark and Anna sent me a neat little piece of technology, which hopefully in the near future will improve the sound quality of the interviews that I record on location. So thank you very much to Mark and Anna, and again, check out their website. It's waldeneffect.org. So there's the roundup of the folks who deserve special thanks for their hand in creating this week's episode of the Sea Realm podcast, but of course, the listenership makes it all possible, so thank you very much for listening to the Sea Realm podcast. And now, here is my interview with Derek Jensen.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO,
and I'm joined by author Derek Jensen. He is the author of many books, including A Language Older Than Words,
The Culture of Make-Believe, and most recently, Songs of the Dead. Derek Jensen, thank you very much for appearing on the Sea Realm Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me back.
And last week, you know, we were talking a bit about technology, but I wanted to sort of carry on an interview that I heard you give on a Montreal radio station, and I sort of wanted to pick up and have you reiterate a couple of them and then sort of develop them, because they seemed like really promising ideas that needed to be developed. And the first one that comes to mind is you've got sort of an impatience with this idea that it's individuals making individual choices and changes in their lifestyle that really needs to be the forefront of changing the way that we're going globally, that, you know, we shouldn't castigate individual people for eating sushi when governments are artificially, you know, making fishing an economically viable activity when without subsidies it wouldn't be. And that global capitalism and corporate,
you know, industrial capitalism is just given, and we can't really think about changing that. So we have to direct our focus to the choices that individual humans make. And I'm wondering if you'd pick up from there and just take that a little further.
Well, sure. Yeah, I would be happy to. That's a dreadful mistake that we in this culture make. And it's not really even a mistake, as it is a dead end. An Inconvenient Truth is a really good example of that, where what happens is that movie gave a really good introduction to global warming. And then when it came time for solutions, I don't know if you noticed, but all the solutions were aimed at the individual. Suddenly, they don't talk about the growth economy. They don't talk about corporate power. What they talk about instead are changing light bulbs, inflating tires. And if everybody in the United States did everything that the movie suggested, that would lower U.S. carbon emissions by 22%. And the scientific consensus, of course, is that it needs to be reduced by 70 to 80%. And more importantly, since Al Gore did not talk out against the growth economy, all of that gain of 22% would be lost within a couple years through economic growth. This happens all the time. Another way to say all this is the 1980s was the first time that corporate newspapers called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And this is really crucial, because if we've been sold a total bill of goods, because if those in power can get you to define yourself as a consumer, your range of resistance is reduced greatly. It's reduced basically to buying and not buying. On the other hand, if you're a citizen, you can buy, not buy, vote, not vote, boycott, you can organize, you can pamphlet, and when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you have the right to alter or abolish it. And there's another transformation that took place a long time ago that's even more wrenching, which was that at some point in, you know, several thousand years ago, we accepted the transition from human animals who live in community and require habitat to citizens of a state. And one of the bargains that you make, and this is all sort of sociology 101, one of the bargains you make when you become a citizen of a nation state is you grant the state a monopoly on violence. And animals don't do that. Human animals don't do that. And my point in bringing all this up is that it's really pathetic. When we look to the past, you know, when we think about the resistance against the Nazis in World War II, say you're a member of the French Resistance, we're having this meeting as to what we're going to do to stop the Nazis, and somebody says, hey, let's do compost piles. And somebody else says, hey, let's ride bikes to work. And it'd be a comedy. You know, it's just absurd. But now with the entire world at stake, this is a sort of pathetic response that we get from most environmentalists. And I want to contrast that with MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of Niger Delta, that has reduced oil production in Nigeria by 20% by sabotage, by blowing up pipelines and facilities. And MEND has said to the oil industry, the government can no longer protect your assets or your workers, so you can either leave Nigeria or you can die here. And that's a more honest thing than has been said by any environmentalist in this country, including me. And the point is that, okay, let's take this another direction, which is that, okay, so, you know, the world's running out of water. We gotta take shorter showers because people are dying of thirst. But 90% of the water that's used by humans is used by agriculture and industry. And of the water that's used by municipal humans, that's the same amount of water as is used for municipal golf courses. So we hear all the time that we have to take shorter showers, but there's this disconnect because that's taking responsibility back onto me. And it's like stage magic, you know, it's like sleight of hand, because what they're doing is they're convincing you that you are the problem instead of looking where the problem is, which is ExxonMobil, which is ConocoPhillips, which is, you know, all the corporations that run the planet, run the economic system. And it's entirely ignoring the fact that we don't live in a democracy. I mean, I used to ask my students when I taught at Eastern Washington University, fairly conservative school, I would say, how many of you believe we live in a democracy? Nobody would raise their hand. I said, how many of you believe that the government takes better care of human beings or corporations? And they would laugh. It's a silly question. But that's not what we talk about. Instead, what we end up talking about is whether I can personally consume a little bit less. But and fine, if you want to live simply, that's great. You know, I actually live pretty simply myself, but that's mainly because I'm a cheapskate. You know, it's got nothing to do with it's not a revolutionary act, you know, and I don't have children, you know, I do all those, you know, I recycle paper, all that stuff. I can't throw a piece of paper in the recycling bin until I've, like, used every little bit to scribble on. And so, but I think that's actually not really a politically powerful act. I think that's kind of obsessive compulsive. And so, you know, I don't have a problem with simple living, but I have a real problem with pretending. Oh, like, I just got a note today. This so annoyed me. This guy who should know way better said that the most meaningful resistance today is lifestyle change on the individual level that is ideally known to the wider community. It's like, that's meaningless. That's not resistance at all. I mean, can you imagine the Irish, you know, they want to force the British off their land, so it's like, okay, let's eat more potatoes or less potatoes or, it's like, you know, let's drink less, let's drink more, let's do... Lifestyle change has nothing to do with that. That has nothing to do with organized political resistance. What we need to do is we need to organize and we need to figure out how we want to resist, and then we need to do it. I mean, this makes a mockery of... I got a note from somebody else a few days ago, and this made me so angry. This person said, one can never resist. I mean, resistance never works. He said, resistance cannot work. And it's like... The IRA says hello, and the ANC says hello. There's this whole thing called apartheid that ended. What about the Afghans who forced out the British, and then they later forced out the Soviets? And there's the Indians who forced out the British. There's the Vietnamese who forced out the Americans. What about the suffragettes? I mean, the suffragettes didn't do what they did. I mean, they didn't accomplish voting rights for women through changing their lifestyles. See, that's part of the problem, too, is because the suffragettes, they weren't the problem. That's, I mean, another way to try to go at this is that, you know, there are a lot of men are raping a lot of women. The gold standard study is that 25% of all women in this culture get raped in their lifetime. Another 19% fend off rape attempts. And most of the women I know say those figures are pretty low. Well, the problem isn't that women need to change their lifestyles. The problem is that men need to stop raping. And if men are not going to stop raping, then they need to be stopped. And we can say the same thing for corporations. We can say the same thing. You know, slave owners didn't give up slaves because they had a... Here's another example of this, is that Rosa Parks by herself, all that happens is she gets arrested on the bus. She wasn't just some random person. She was ready for this, and she was organized. She had been trained for this, and she had the entire African-American community behind her. So Rosa Parks by herself gets arrested, big deal. Rosa Parks and the entire African American community brings the bus companies to their knees. They didn't change the policies because the people who ran the bus companies suddenly said, "Oh my God, I've been racist for all these years." Instead, they did it through organized political resistance, which does not have to mean violence. It can, but it doesn't have to. In the case of the bus boycott, it was not violent. And we can say the same thing for trash. You know, we can go through with the thing I said about water, you know, 90% of the water is used by agriculture and industry. Same thing for trash. In the United States, let's say you reduce your, I think the average person in the United States has, produces about 1,600 pounds of trash a year. And, let's say you're this super duper simple living activist and you reduce that to zero. You don't throw anything away. And, well, I got bad news for you because that's only 3% of your total waste production per capita. 97% of waste production in the United States is industry. And so all you can do by, you know, wearing your ratty tennis shoes until they fall off and fixing your toaster, all that's done is reduce your percentage of the trash by at most 3%. The problem is not us. The problem is the entire system. And I want to say one more thing about this, which is years and years and years ago, I was talking to this American Indian friend of mine, and I was saying, gosh, I feel so bad because I'm responsible for global warming because I drive a car. And she just looked at me like I was an idiot. And for good reason. And she said, "You didn't make car culture. Don't take responsibility for what's not yours. Instead, what you need to do is to work to take down car culture." And that's the thing that so many of the simple living activists don't understand, is that our culpability is not simply just what we consume. Our culpability is because we allow this wretched system to stand. I mean, picture this. Go back to the rape example. You got 10 men in a room and one woman. And let's say that some of the men in the room start to rape that woman. Well, you know, I'm not going to participate. I'm extremely pure. I'm not even going to watch. I'm going to look away. Well, what the hell good does that do? You see what I'm trying to get at with that? Is your own person, unless you stop the injustice. See, there's another part of the problem, is this notion that just because you don't participate fully in the system, that you're not culpable, but you're culpable because you don't stop an injustice. And that's what we need to do, is we need to stop these injustices. And we can recognize this if we put it as starkly as someone being assaulted right in front of our face. In that circumstance, we would recognize that we're culpable because all we did was not participate. But that's not good enough, especially with all the world at stake.
Well, let me ask you about resistance. I work for an enormous media corporation, and I do tech support. I provide tech support for phone and internet services. And this corporation, you know, it's not an individual. It doesn't do anything for personal reasons. It just maximizes shareholder value and, you know, squeezes as much as it can out of the workers and gives the customers as little as it can get away with in terms of service and, you know, keeping things running. And people around this part of the country hate this corporation that I work for. And when they call and they get me on the phone and I answer in a very pleasant tone of voice and I honestly want to help them out and I, you know, I do everything to keep the conversation productive, but they're not talking to me. They're talking to the personification, or so they think, of this corporation, which they hate. And it really takes a psychic toll on me. And, you know, they're not being violent. They're not shooting at me. They're not, putting bombs in my car or anything. But to really effect opposition to a corporation, to use violence against a corporation, it seems you have to use violence against people. And the corporation and its behavior is not the aggregate, you know, moral sensibilities of the people that work for it. The corporation can be staffed mainly by, you know, principled, ethical people, but because it does what it does and because it's structured in a certain way and, you know, is required by law to maximize shareholder value, it's going to behave abominably. How can you resist, particularly in the way that you mentioned the people in the Niger Delta resist a corporation and resist a big impersonal structure like that without hurting people or without, you know, directing violence against people?
Well, MEND is armed, and if someone resists them blowing up a pipeline or a facility, they will kidnap them and hold them for ransom, or they'll kill them. And I have a couple things to say. One is that I think it's clearly misdirected for someone to get mad at you. And, I mean, Walmart is an evil corporation. I think you and I can both agree on that, right? Walmart is egregiously awful. And,
but yeah, you don't take your anger out on the old lady who's at the front door.
Oh, you might not, but I sure do.
Well, you know,
no,
she's not responsible for anything. She's just standing there in great pain, you know.
Oh, I know. Absolutely, that's my point, is that, you know, when, okay, I'll admit it, you know, I take my mom to Walmart, you know, I'm not pure. Anyway, so if I take my mom to Walmart, you know, we're pleasant to the people there and pleasant to the people working behind the counter. It's like, you know, they're just people who probably hate Walmart even more than I do. And so, yeah, that anger at you is utterly misdirected. I think a couple things. One is that I don't think we could make the same argument for anger that was directed at the upper level management. I think that those people are culpable and they can be held responsible. For example, one of the jokes I used to tell.
But you have no access to them. You only have access to me.
Well, see, and that's why, you know, I think that we need to be really clear. That's where being really clear in your analysis really, in one's analysis, really helps. Because it helps. Years ago, somebody asked me, how does your anger at the dominant culture affect your sex life? And, I mean, of course, it was none of that person's business. But I realized later that that person was acting on the notion that, or asking that question on the notion that my anger is a shotgun that just gets, you know, sprayed around everywhere, a machine gun that gets sprayed everywhere. But the truth is I'm angry at those who make me angry. I'm not angry at those who don't make me angry. And so, you know, if I called you at Acme Evil Corporation, I wouldn't be upset at you. There's no reason for me to be. And just because I can't get access to, you know, the CEO of Acme Evil Corporation doesn't mean that I should displace this anger on you. And so we should be very clear about that. But once again, oh, back to the joke that I used to tell was that having to do with the judicial system is, what do you get when you cross a long drug habit? It's two riddles that aren't very funny. What do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. On the other hand, what do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? And the answer is retirement with full pay and benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, Bhopal. And that's one of the functions of government, is to protect those in power as they systematically steal from the poor and destroy the planet. And we need to break through those barriers. We need to bring, if that's one of the things we need to do and to say, is that if the government is not going to hold you accountable, we will hold you accountable. And then I want to take this a different direction for a second, or maybe it's the same direction, actually, that, you know, Adolf Eichmann, all he did really was run trains. You know, he didn't actually personally shoot any Jews. He was actually, my understanding is that he actually wasn't even particularly, you know, he didn't have a huge hatred of Jews. He just was doing his job, running railroads, making them run on time. And for that, he was held accountable because of he was part of this larger project. And that's one of the problems with bureaucracies, is that it doesn't matter whether the purpose of the bureaucracy is to, you know, make sure that every little girl has her own happy pink fuzzy unicorn with wings, or whether it's to fabricate weapons of mass destruction, that you still have to have people answer the phones. I just wrote this the other day, that You know, somebody still has to answer the phones at death camps. And the person who's answering the phone could be a very, very nice person. In fact, Robert J. Lifton wrote this great book called The Nazi Doctors, which asked how it was that men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go in and work in death camps. And that's all. See, that's part of the thing, back to this question of purity, is that, you know, you work for Acme Evil Corporation, but, you know, if we all wanted to talk about purity, you could quit your job and then, you know, I don't know how you're supposed to pay your rent. I guess you could live on air or something. But see, that's where this whole simple living thing falls apart again, is because that's not the point. The point is that we have to go after the corporation itself. And we can talk about the level of culpability of individuals that I think clearly, okay, since I don't know what corporation you're talking about, I'll just say Freeport McMoRan is this really nasty, it's the most polluting company in the world, at least it was a couple of years ago, really nasty mining company. They machine gun indigenous peoples. They've done just terrible, terrible atrocities. And I think that the CEO should be held accountable. And I think we can go down the list. And there probably is some accountability for, I mean, there probably is some evil at the level of somebody who answers the telephone, but that's way, way, way down the list. You know, it's like, let's worry about the ones who are actually decision makers first. I mean, let's bring them to justice before we worry about somebody answering a telephone. That's just silly. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast, and I'm joined by Derek Jensen, and we've been talking about resistance and directing one's resistance at the right targets. And Derek, that is a fascinating topic and one that, you know, I wrestle with continuously, but I'd like to set it aside for a moment and talk about the way humans live on the Earth right now. You say that our culture is the most destructive that the world has ever seen. What do you mean by our culture? Where does that begin and end? What are the lines of demarcation for our culture?
Well, I would say Western civilization. And, you know, the culture that really began in, you know, what's now Iraq, and then it sort of metastasized across the globe. And you can say, well, you know, yeah, there's still Chinese culture, there's still, you know, cultures in Japan, there's still all this. But it's like I turn on the television, I see people wearing ties and driving cars everywhere in the world. So, you know, I see capitalism is ascendant. Or it's like, who was it who said this? Was it Mary Daly? It was one feminist said that there's only one religion in the world right now, and it's patriarchy. And I think that's all really true. Basically, as long as you see somebody either wearing a tie or driving a car, you know, the culture's been mixed down pretty well. And so where did it begin? It began there. And that's another thing is that we'll skip that for now. So where did it begin? It began with that. And it's the culture that's based on consumption of land bases. That's actually the direction I was just going to go, is that they say that one sign of intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. I'm going to lay out a pattern. Let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years. And that's when you think of Iraq, is the first thing that you think of cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? That's what Iraq was like prior to the beginning of this culture. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills of Iraq to make great cities. The Arabian Peninsula was oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. Italy was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. The forests of North Africa went down for Phoenician and Egyptian navies. The Americas obviously were heavily forested. And there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere. The reason is because they were all exterminated. They're called great auks, A-U-K-S. There were great flocks of passenger pigeons that were so thick they darkened the sky for days at a time. There were six times as many passenger pigeons as all of the birds in North America combined. They were eradicated. There's 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone. You know, we can just go on and on and on with this. And what this culture has done is based on extraction. It's not based on inhabitation. The Talua Indians lived, I live on Talua land here, and the Talua lived here continuously for 12,500 years at least. And the place was a paradise when the first Europeans arrived here. And the other place is trash. I mean, there were salmon so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in water for they would capsize. And now the most salmon I've ever seen at one time is maybe two, three, four. And salmon are just getting totally hammered. And that's what this culture does, is extract in order to create this way of living. And you ask, where does it begin and where does it end? Where it began was there, and where it ends is very soon with the end of cheap oil, or the end of cheap energy. And it can't end a moment too soon because it's killing the planet.
Well, before we started turning petroleum into food and thereby into human biomass, there was about 1 billion people on the planet. And now we're pushing 7 billion, which, you know, leads me to wonder, with the end of cheap oil, are we going to see a dramatic culling of the human population, something, you know, that I sort of wryly refer to as a Malthusian correction? It seems likely to me. I wonder what your thoughts are on it, and if it's something that you think of as, you know, a necessary pain that we have to endure in order to get back to something that is sustainable.
Well, there are definitely more humans on the planet than the planet can support, and there will someday be far fewer humans. And every cell in my body wants for that to be a voluntary transformation. You know, a joke that I've made for a long time is that if I ran for president, it would be on the campaign of vasectomies on the house. And my slogan would be a snip in every sack. And but that's not going to happen. And there will someday be far fewer people than there are at present. And it's not going to be pretty. And that needs to happen. And frankly, the sooner it happens, the better. And when I say that, I don't say that blithely, because I'll be in the second wave of those dead. The first wave are, you know, people on iron lungs or whatever. The second wave will be people like me. I have Crohn's disease, and right now I take a high-tech medicine in order to survive. And so when civilization crashes, you know, without the entire electrical grid, everything else, I would be dead in a few months. And the important thing is that my life is not more important than the health of the planet. And no human life is more important than the health of the planet. And part of our problem is this human supremacy that sets humans above all others. And there will be a major Malthusian correction. I don't know. We can argue about how many there will be. What would be sustainable at this point? 500 million? 250 million? A lot fewer than there were before, because the salmon are gone. The passenger pigeons are gone. You know, that's one of the things. 50 years from now, people are going to be sitting along the banks of the Columbia, and they'll be starving to death because people now didn't take out the dams that were killing salmon. And it's pretty extraordinary that sometimes I get accused of being anti-human because, you know, of everything I talk about. But the truth is, the long-term anthropocentrism is the same thing as biocentrism, long-term, because... Oh, here's another story that my friend Stephanie McMillan, who, with whom I wrote As the World Burns, she used to be married to this guy from Bangladesh. And when he was a child, this is just in his lifetime, when he was a child, his mother would say, go out and catch lunch for us at the river. And he would go catch fish. And now there are no fish in the river because of industrial pollution. Nowadays, the fish they get comes from Iceland, I think. And that's just in the last 20 years. So 20 years ago, if civilization would have crashed 20 years ago, the people in his community could have survived on the fish from the river. they can't anymore. And the longer we wait, the worse things are going to be, not just for humans, but for everybody, because so much of what we see around us is collapsing. And that, once again, creates problems for them, for those others, for frogs, for bats. But it also is going to create problems for the humans who come after. And if I were a space alien looking down at what humans are currently doing, industrial humans especially, I would think that they were doing everything they could to make the crash as severe as possible. I would just shake my head and say, what is wrong with these people? Because we could have a voluntary transformation. We could use so much of our cleverness to, you know, have this sort of glide down, but it's not going to happen. And I see nothing moving us in that direction. And it's absolutely extraordinary that things just continue to get worse. I mean, what do you do if you walk in? I mean, global warming is caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas. And if you were to ask any reasonably intelligent 6 or 7 year old, how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, they could give you a reasonable answer. And if you ask any reasonably intelligent 35-year-old who works for a green high-tech consulting firm how to stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, they'll give you some answer that has to do with, you know, shooting tiny mirrors up into space or something. But think about it this way. If you walk into your bathroom and the bathtub is overflowing and the water's on, what's the first thing you do? You turn off the water. But we're not doing that. And, okay, to take this back to the whole simple living thing in a way, is if the dams on the Colorado River failed, and the Colorado River were once again able to reach the ocean, how weird would that be? You know, I could hear, you know, the capitalist press just braying as one that you know, people are going to die of thirst. But I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there existed a single alfalfa field that was irrigated, so long as there existed a single irrigated citrus orchard, so long as there existed a single golf course, so long as there existed a swimming pool, so long as there existed lawns, so long as Las Vegas existed. It's like we could have a power down if we wanted. Let's get rid of retractable stadium roofs. You know, how's that for an idea? But none of that stuff is going to happen. Let's get rid of the frickin' military. That's not going to happen either. And so what's happening is it's just this this insanity is just going faster and faster and harder and harder. And the faster and harder it goes now, the harder it's going to crash. And we're actually already seeing the crash. It's happening, not only the ecological crash, but my hope and my belief is that this is the economic crash that capitalism doesn't recover from.
Now, to say that's your hope, I mean, that's something you can say in the Sea Realm podcast, but to say that out in the mainstream corporate media, you know, that's blasphemy of the highest order. I mean, we've got to get back to growth. All of our efforts are to get, you know, back to economic growth and to continue the party.
Well, yeah, but, you know, when you have a cult, you have to have some blasphemers. I mean, that's part of my role, is to say the things that we all know in our hearts, but go against the culture, and for which I get attacked pretty soundly, but that's my role. And my loyalty is to the truth as I understand it to be, and my loyalty is to the natural world. My loyalty is not to the system. See, that's part of the problem, too, is that I did this terrible, terrible radio interview a couple years ago. This guy from Santa Barbara, he's an anti-environmental, property rights, uber allahs, Bible thumper. And he basically wanted to interview me because he wanted an environmentalist to yell at. And I was telling him, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, and there's docks in every mother's breast milk, and salmon are getting hammered, and sharks are getting hammered, and on and on and on. And he kept saying the same thing back to me, which is, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back in the real world.
And yeah, the real world of numbers and money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, that's a big part of the problem is that question. I mean, this gets back to the whole epistemology thing, is that what is real? And what is real for many of these people is the economic system. What do all of the so-called solutions, the global warming, the mainstream solutions, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that is literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because the natural world, the real world, has to be the independent variable. with any social system being the dependent variable, because no real world, no social system. As opposed to, once again, the way people think about it and the way they talk about it. You know, two college students will be talking to each other. What are you going to do when you get out in the real world? What they mean is, what are you going to do when you have to get a job? What I'm going to do when I get out in the real world is I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? That's the real world. And people forget that the real world is the real world of frogs and chimpanzees and porpoises and salmon and newts, bats, and air. And the truth is that the people who come after, the human people who come after, are not going to care about whether we wrote books or whether we did podcasts or whether we did activism or whether we didn't do activism or whether we voted, you know, left, right, center, didn't vote at all. They're not going to care about any of that. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water and whether the land can support them. And that's the bottom line. And the bottom line has to be the real physical world. And so, yeah, they want to have economic growth. Well, I mean, it doesn't take a cognitive giant to figure out you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And it's just a really bad idea.
Well, you've mentioned dams a few times now, and there was a time in your life when you'd wake up in the morning and ask yourself, am I going to write books or am I going to go blow up dams today? And you always chose to write books, but you weren't sure it was the right decision. But you did choose to write books, and I'm thinking that you must think that there is some value in that, you know, to continue to sway people's thinking and to, you know, put an idea that with the right support can grow into something that actually does make a change, and that blowing up dams or, you know, doing something else that is directly impacting on the real physical world, doing something to change the way people think and the way they talk about these issues, it's got to have some value. Otherwise, I don't think you'd keep doing it.
Well, it may have an indirect value, but the question is whether it helps the salmon, because I don't do this. I mean, I love writing, and I love my life. I'm really happy. And at the same time, I am doing this. It's a yes-no question. You know, either we stop this culture from killing the planet or we don't. You know, either the salmon survive or they don't. And so if I can help people to find what they love and then defend their beloved, then that's good. And if I'm not doing this as an intellectual exercise, and I'm doing this as part of the resistance. You know, Sinn Féin was important to, at some point, Sinn Féin was important to the IRA, to the whole Irish nationalist movement. Another way to say all this, we need above ground, we need below ground activities. With the Underground Railroad, you needed people like Harriet Tubman, and you also needed people who ran safe houses. Even when the IRA was at its strongest, only 2% of the people ever picked up weapons. The other 98% did various other types of work. And part of the work that's really important is helping to create a culture of resistance where we can, where we make it safe for other people to talk about how there has to be, that the infinite growth is insane. And to make it safe for people to talk about how do we bring accountability to CEOs who are destroying communities, and to make it safe to move those discussions forward. It's like I was watching this movie, The Battle of Algiers, with a friend of mine, and it's a great, great movie, probably the best movie ever about an insurgency. It's about the Algerian insurgency against the French. And I'm watching this movie, and I say to my friend, so who would I be in this film? And I was just asking for strokes, you know, supposed to be like, oh, you're one of the really brave ones. And my friend said, oh, you'd be dead. And I was like, thank you very much. And my friend said, no. You'd be dead for 30 years because your books are on the bookshelves of all the insurgents. And that really helped me, and it helped me understand my role a little bit better, that my role is to help create that culture of resistance. And you know, sometimes people say, well, gosh, Derek, why did you not, why don't you blow up dams? And one of my answers, which is kind of flip, but it's also kind of true, is that my only D in college was in quantitative analysis chemistry lab. And So you really don't want me messing around with explosives. I'm a klutz. Physically, I'm just not very good at things. Or another way to say all this is that a question I ask people all the time when they say, what should I do? One of the things, there are two responses I have all the time. One of them is, what are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? What are the largest, most pressing problems that you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? And I do not have a gift for chemistry, for explosives. I do not have a gift. People have said, gosh, quit writing and be an organizer. I do not have a gift for organizing. And I'm an introvert. I don't really like talking to people. And so, you know, but I do like writing, and I'm good at it. And the other question is, what do you get off on? That I was working with this wetland specialist a couple years ago, and I asked him, you know, he was digging up some soil, and then he would rub it between his fingers, and they would compare the color of the soil to this chart, and that would help him determine if it was wetlands. And we were trying to work together to stop this developer. And when he's, you know, reaching down and digging up the soil, I looked at him and I said, do you get off on this? And he started laughing and said, yeah, this is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs. And I started laughing and I said, man, I would hate this. But on the other hand, I've condemned myself to a life of homework. You know, I get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. And so that's another question, is what do people get off on? And we need it all. And so back to the question, do I see some value in it? I don't know. I despair. I despair a lot. Because I just don't know. You know, I used to be a beekeeper, and there was a really nice thing about beekeeping is that I would have a jar of honey. I'd have a lot of jars of honey. I had 300 hives. So I would have honey. I would have jars of honey at the end of the season, and that's a tangible thing. And I can have a book, but it always comes back to, does it help the salmon? You know, I guess it's not a good example because the honey doesn't help the salmon either. At least people can eat it. But back to the original point, does it help the salmon? If I were to take out dams, yes, that would help the salmon. But do my books help achieve something in the real physical world? I don't know the answer to that. And that's the question.
We started this conversation, and from the perspective of the listeners, it was a week ago now, talking about singularitarians and you know, the people who are enthusiastic about artificial intelligence and the possibilities that it holds out. There's another group of related sort of ideologues, and there's a big overlap between them and the singularitarians, and those are the transhumanists. And these are folks that are very keen to upgrade humanity, to, you know, improve it. And one idea that comes across a lot with folks is that in order for humanity to get out of a lot of the sort of the troubles that we get ourselves into with our atavistic desires and urges and, you know, territoriality and aggression, is we need to change human nature. We need to rewrite it, you know, at the source code level. And it strikes me that human nature, just as it is right now, stood us in good stead for a very long time before the advent of this culture that has consumed everything, this extraction culture. And it just doesn't seem to me that human nature is to blame. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that and on the whole prospect in general of upgrading humanity.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, the short version is that, once again, the Tal lived here for 12,500 years. The problem is not human nature. And we could go into this whole discussion of Ruth Benedict trying to figure out why some cultures are good and some cultures are bad, and it basically boiling down to humans are social animals. And if your culture reinforces behavior that benefits the group as a whole and disallows behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group, that's what you get. And if you benefit, on the other hand, if you reward behavior, socially reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the group, that's what you'll get. And so if we live in the same community and I go hunting and I, you know, I go fishing and I get a bunch of salmon and then I bring them back and I keep them all to myself, that would be unheard of in a healthy functioning tribal community. Instead, I give it to everybody and everybody goes, oh my God, you're the greatest, and they've socially rewarded me for sharing. And if, on the other hand, I do hold it, like the XHOSA of South Africa, if anybody went hunting and didn't share the food with everyone, everybody else would laugh like a hyena at them. They would make fun of them. And there were some cultures in the Pacific Northwest that had shaming poles that you would put in front of somebody's house. It's basically because I'm an asshole. And this culture rewards acquisition. And so, I mean, this is just behavior mod 101, that if you reward behavior that benefits the group, then that's the behavior you're going to get. And so the problem is not human nature. The problem is social rewards. So that's my short answer. And if they really think the problem is human nature, and if they care about the world, then what they need to do is kill off humans. I don't believe that, but that's sort of taking that to the end point. And then there's a whole thing about connecting with the machines, too, and this is way too long a discussion for now, but that's something I find really fascinating. From one of my favorite things from Welcome Machine is that the transhumanists are way too late because we're already inside the machine. Right now, if I look around, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I see at least 10 machines immediately. How many wild animals do I see? None. You know, we're inside the machine. And the machine's also a social order, but that's another whole long conversation.
I think the transhumanist response would be, you know, psychologically we're adapted for an environment and for a social organization that no longer exists. And, you know, if short of a huge crash, it's not coming back. We do live in a mechanized environment now. We need to adapt ourselves to operate in that environment.
Well, and I would ask this, I would take it back to the exact same thing I said before, which is what's real. And what's real is not the social structure. That's secondary. What's the dependent and independent variable? The independent variable has to be there's the question. Is biology or are machines primary? And my answer would be the biology, that flesh is primary, and that our instincts from having survived and grown up and evolved in place are primary, and that the machines are secondary. And that's one reason we're so damn neurotic, is because, this could lead to a whole huge discussion of how we've all been driven insane by being surrounded by machines. But once again, it's late, and I need to get some work done. You need to get some sleep. So we should do this again some other time.
Well, Derek Jensen, thank you very much for appearing on the Sea Realm podcast, and have a wonderful evening.
Thanks, you too.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back never to go its back, old never go dimensions. Back.
Well, all right, that was Derek Jensen, author of many books, and in the middle there you heard some music from Tonal Oak. So thank you to Derek, thank you to Tonal Oak, thank you to everybody who contributed to this installment of the Sea Realm podcast, and thank you, dear listener, for listening. That is all the time that I have for this week's installment. I frequently omit this part, but let me just say that this installment and every installment of the Sea Realm podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license, and you can learn more about what that means at the Creative Commons website. Next week is the annual 9/11 themed show. Do join me for that. It will be on 090909. Folks who are into numbers, you are more than welcome to send me your ideas about the significance of that date. You can reach me at kmo@crealm.com. That is the letter C, and then a hyphen, and then realm.com. Well, thank you very much for joining me. Do join me again next week, and until that time, stay well.